Laure Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the show today, we have a panel discussion on preventing epidemic. COVID-19 and recent outbreaks of monkeypox are two examples of how vulnerable the world is to infectious diseases. But experts say every day, public health workers stop epidemics before they start. In its new report, Epidemics That Didn't Happen, the organization Resolved to Save Lives highlights some successful outbreak responses from around the world. How did they happen and what should be some priorities to prevent epidemics from evolving? To answer these questions and more, I spoke with Dr. Precious Matsoso, former Director General of South Africa Department of Health and co-chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Body for Pandemic Treaty with WHO. She joined us from South Africa. And Amanda McLellan, Senior Vice President of Resolve to Save Lives, who joins us from New York City. Take a listen. Amanda McLellan and Precious Matsoso, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Let me start with you, Amanda McLellan. You are the Senior Vice President of Prevent Epidemics at Resolve to Save Lives. Resolve to Save Lives has just released its latest report titled Epidemics That Didn't Happen. Very interesting name, and it highlights some positive outcomes by countries and communities in stopping certain epidemics. First and foremost, give us a sense of this report, what transpires in the report, what are some of the main takeaways?
Yeah, we're really proud of this report, and we think it's a really important message. So often with the big outbreaks, especially COVID, but also monkeypox and Ebola, we hear so much about how public health isn't working, but we wanted to make sure that people understood that public health is working really hard with communities at local level and at national level to find outbreaks every day and make sure that they don't happen. And so this report really helps us shine a light on the success that happens every day and how important public health is into keeping us all healthy and safe, and making sure that we focus on sometimes the things that we did well and how do we scale those and improve those and not always just on the things that went wrong.
Precious Matsoso, you are the co-chair of Intergovernmental Negotiating Body for Pandemic Treaty with WHO, among other things, among other responsibilities that you have. We've seen a lot of epidemics, many outbreaks these past few years. I mean, COVID shook the world. What has worked in certain epidemics that did not get to the gravity that we've seen with COVID-19?
The first thing is about those countries that made huge investments in their preparedness. You can see from the results that those who made the best buys, those who made wise investments, they're the ones who actually succeeded in curbing not only COVID, but on daily basis in addressing some of the outbreaks and before they even become epidemics or before they even become pandemics. So what are those wise investments? The first is if you put in place measures that are embedded in communities, I think it's a first win because outbreaks start and end in communities. The second, if you invest in training your health workers, including community health workers, and you also build your primary healthcare system, there's another huge and big and important investment. The third is about your surveillance systems and systems to be able to detect early. Because if you can detect early and report to relevant institutions and authorities and respond rapidly, I think you're already halfway towards fighting this problem. And I think what we intend to do, we make investments in responses, and perhaps we should turn this around, make a call for investment in preparedness.
Amanda McLellan, so we know these steps. These steps are laid out. Precious Matsoso mentioned some of them. But when we look at the impact that COVID-19 has had, a lot of times we hear that countries that are perhaps low and middle income and not as wealthy as the United States, for example, are more vulnerable. But when we saw how much COVID had impacted the world, regardless of economic status, what does it tell us in terms of where the priority should be to prevent
epidemic.
I think every country has a responsibility, whether it's low income or high income. And I think, you know, we saw the UK and the US, as well as other high income countries, really struggle with COVID for a number of reasons. We've called attention to some of the successes from the lower and middle income countries who fight epidemics every day and actually did a better job at the beginning stages of COVID in communicating risks to their communities, having their community health workers out there building trust and explaining the control measures. But we also saw COVID wear away the resilience of those systems. There was a heavy toll on communities and health systems, and especially healthcare workers. And we're seeing the impact of that today. We saw a report from WHO and others today, 26 measles outbreaks around the world at the moment because we lost progress on vaccine coverage. We have more than 26 cholera outbreaks around the world where climate conditions and breakdown in health systems is leading to rapid spread of cholera. And obviously the sub-Saharan African countries really struggling with drought and malnutrition at the moment. So I think there's a lot to learn from low-income and middle-income countries in how they addressed COVID with a holistic approach. But we've definitely seen an erosion of their capacity and resilience in their communities. And we're seeing some of those outbreaks that used to be fairly easy to control, like measles and cholera, really surging back now. And I think that really shows that this is a constant investment. We need to sustain and expand this investment. Diseases that we thought we had conquered, like polio, will take every opportunity to come back. And so the Epidemics That Didn't Happen report really demonstrates that this is a fight that we have to make every day, an investment that we have to make every day to make sure that we control outbreaks and reduce the impact for all countries.
Precious, when we talk about building strong preparedness systems and decisive response plans, what does it look like, especially if we compare, you know, between high-income countries and low- and middle-income countries? What does it look like?
Well, I would like to use two examples by way of illustration. I mean, you know, Guinea suffered the most devastating effects of Ebola between 2013 and 2016. They lost 11,000 lives, and their livelihoods and their economy was negatively affected. But if you look at how Guinea responded with the Ebola outbreak in 2022, it was a totally different story. So the question is, what happened between then and now is that they actually started building their systems. And when you build systems, you have to test them on a constant basis to establish if they're resilient or not. Let me use an example. I like using this example because it's what people like, you know, you can relate with it. When you get into a plane, I don't know how many times an air hostess and a crew tell you that, please fasten up. They repeat the same story. You've heard it all over again, but they keep on doing it. So we say, even if you do have those plans, do simulation exercises, test them, see if they work over and over again, so that you are prepared. So your health workforce must be trained and you must ensure that they are competent. Secondly, your lab systems and the speed at which you get results must be good. Because it's not enough if you have laboratory services, but your results are delayed. And it is a huge investment that you need. The CDC always talks about, I call them disease detectives. Train your disease detectives so that they can be able to detect early and be able to respond. And that response must be with speed. There's a proposal to say, and this idea of having a 717, it's a very easy number to use, you know, to say within those 7 days, detect and establish what has happened. And within a day, report. And within 7 days, you must be able to respond and be on top of the outbreak. So I'm saying that we have not come up with these rigorous measures and matrices. We just say, oh, they didn't respond on time, or they didn't detect early. But we've never said how long and is acceptable time frames. You know, it must happen within a stipulated time frames. And I think this idea of 717, if you have a plan and in your simulation exercises, test this 717 and see how best it works.
Very good point. Amanda, what surprised you in this report this time around, and what sort of impact do you anticipate or do you hope this report can make in future outbreaks?
This report, what surprised me was, to Dr. Matasso's point, was the progress that Guinea had made. I was there in 2014. The system was, you know, the community was heavily devastated and overwhelmed, and they made smart strategic investments. And I was really proud to see that they identified Ebola quickly and they controlled it quickly and they shared those lessons. Similar to DRC, who faces this Ebola challenge regularly and are able to find those outbreaks and respond to one of the scariest, you know, highly infectious diseases in the world. So that really surprised me. And then I think the Indonesian example about communities finding solutions for themselves. The Indonesian community faced the challenge of dengue. It's very hard to control. They're surrounded by water and mosquitoes, but they found community-based solutions that help them identify when someone in the community has dengue, and they take local action. They don't wait for the Ministry of Health to come. They don't wait for someone else to come. They mobilize quickly and they try to address where the mosquitoes are breeding. They get their community members to the clinic quickly, and they were able to control the ongoing spread of dengue in those communities. So I think it's two great examples where communities are really driving the action to control epidemics at their source, and a government that really identified that epidemics are a social and political and economic event, not just a health event, and invested smartly to make sure that they didn't suffer the same fate that they did during 2014. So they're the two kind of ends of the spectrum that really surprised me about the report.
To what extent is there a leverage when you're already dealing with an epidemic that you are familiar with? For example, DRC faced with Ebola, we might have an easier path than, I don't know, any other country that has never seen Ebola, for example. There is that. And there's also the fact that more outbreaks that are coming up, there are zoonotics and there will be zoonotics according to reports. So does the nature of the outbreak also perhaps has a leverage in terms of containing it easier or not? And either one of you can go.
Well, maybe let me start by saying I omitted to mention that I use the three C's of coordination, cooperation, and collaboration as key elements of a response. I'm raising that because a country that I would have used now is Uganda. Why I would say Uganda? Of course, they've got an Ebola now, but my previous experience having visited Uganda is that I visited them at a time when they had multiple outbreaks happening all at once. They were not dealing with one. They had cholera. They had Marburg fever. They were dealing with three or four outbreaks. And on top of that, they had just had floods. So, but they were able to respond because they had put systems in place. And what was good about what they had put in place was that the level, the unit level of planning was at district level, meaning we tend to think things happen at national level, but your success happens at sub-national level, at local government level. You know, those mayors, chiefs and community leaders, if you bring them on board and you have a script that you use, you work with them, I think you're likely to succeed.
Amanda, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I think you're good at what you practice. And so if you are prepared and you practice for those events, so DRC is practicing regularly for Ebola because they're finding those cases regularly. But that means we need to practice in the US. We're not immune to an Ebola case. Any outbreak is everywhere in 36 hours. And so what we try to do with teams is practice for what happens in your country regularly. And in Africa, we practice a lot for cholera, Ebola, measles, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to practice those things in other locations. And you're right, the chance for a zoonosis spillover, something new, COVID was new. We didn't know that COVID-19 existed, but we had practiced for an outbreak similar to that, a coronavirus, a respiratory virus. So it's a challenge in terms of prioritizing, practicing for what happens every day, making sure that we're good at addressing that and building that trust with health workers and communities that we can deal with those outbreaks, but also having some capacity in the background for something that we haven't seen just yet. Monkeypox, I think, is a great example. We knew it was happening in West Africa, but we didn't expect it to spread the way that it has. And now every country in the world has had to build their systems to be able to respond to monkeypox. So we have to be ready for the everyday and for the unexpected.
When we talk about preparedness, it seems like when there is an outbreak, countries are catching up instead of being one step ahead if they are so well prepared. Any comment on that?
I think preparedness is a choice of investment, and we haven't made that choice regularly enough. Too often we wait for the response to come and we surge in. And there's been some metaphors related to fire. We too often are waiting for the outbreak to occur and rushing to put the fire out, and you're always behind. We need to invest in those fire alarm systems, those rapid response teams, the building codes that limit the chance that fire breaks out. And that's why we think epidemics that didn't happen is important, because when we're successful, when we are in front of it, no one hears. So you only hear about those outbreaks that get out in front of us and we are chasing. But every day, outbreaks are occurring that we are finding, that we are stopping. But too many of them are getting out in front of us and we are playing catch up. And we need to make the smart choice to invest in those systems to reduce the likelihood of that.
I just wanted to say that one of the things that had been established is to conduct evaluations to look at what the level of preparedness of your country is. But when we do those joint external evaluations, I think perhaps what we miss is that it's like a one-time snapshot. You look good at a particular point in time, and that talks to what you're asking about the US and other well-resourced countries, to say when you take a snapshot, you look good at that point in time. 3 months later, you may look different. Mm-hmm. So the idea of those joint external evaluations that trigger the development of a preparedness plans should be tested on an ongoing basis. And I like the example of fire extinguishers. And like I say that in every respect, we have to test, you know, whether these plans are still valid or they need to be configured in any way at any point in time.
Great. Let me take your final words. The main takeaway for you from this report, or looking at the general picture when it comes to preventing or stopping epidemic, and I will start with you, Amanda.
Yeah, I think we're really proud of the report and to be able to shine the great work of public health and communities in finding outbreaks quickly and responding and controlling them, and highlighting the need to continue that investment consistently so that we're able to do that for every outbreak, and that the epidemics that didn't happen report becomes all outbreaks and not just a handful.
I think perhaps these are lessons learned that can be shared. Those countries that did their best with meager resources, but they were able to tackle these outbreaks, let's share these with others so that they can make those wise investments.
Precious Matsoso, Amanda McLellan, thank you so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
That was a special discussion on preventing epidemics with Dr. Precious Matsoso, former Director General of South Africa's Department of Health and co-chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Body for Pandemic Treaty with WHO, and Amanda McLellan, Senior Vice President of Resolve to Save Lives. We turn now to Ethiopia. The World Health Organization warns that conflict and an ongoing blockade of humanitarian aid into Ethiopia's northern Tigray region is having a devastating impact on the lives and health of millions of people living in dire conditions.
The World Health Organization says 13.1 million people in parts of Ethiopia need health care and humanitarian assistance. More than 5.2 million are in Tigray. Since conflict between the Ethiopian government and Tigray People's Liberation Front began nearly 2 years ago, Tigray has been in a de facto blockade. A recent five-month truce was shattered 2 months ago, cutting off road and air access, as well as humanitarian aid. Ilham Abdelhai Nour is Ethiopia team lead for the WHO's Incident Management System and Emergencies Operations. She says 89% of Tigray's population is food insecure, and 29% of children under five are acutely malnourished.
Malnourished children are usually very sick. They need urgent treatment. Some of them will need hospitalization and around-the-clock care. When they get sick, they tend to get a severe disease. They tend to die as well.
She adds that 55% of pregnant and breastfeeding women also are acutely malnourished and risk getting sick and dying as well. Director of the Health Emergencies Interventions, Altaf Moussani, notes only 9% of health facilities in Tigray are fully functional. He says routine immunization has fallen below 10% this year, putting children at high risk of vaccine-preventable diseases. He says that is particularly dangerous now when drought-affected areas of Ethiopia are reporting outbreaks of cholera and more than 6,000 cases of measles nationally have been confirmed.
In Tigray and in parts surrounding, and we've learned this from COVID, diseases do not know borders. They do not respect those borders. So whether it's measles, malaria, or suspect cases of anthrax, these things will move. And hence, our ability as a system at large to detect and contain them is vital. And in the case of northern Ethiopia, those systems are either stretched or non-existent.
Moussani says the WHO knows what diseases exist and what must be done to treat and prevent people from getting ill. However, he says the WHO has limited access to Tigray. He says the WHO is not able to get life-saving vaccines, fuel, and essential medicine into the area. He says those and other supplies that could make the difference between life and death cannot be brought into the area, and that, he says, is deeply worrying. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Residents in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, are struggling with water shortages after authorities announced rationing due to a drop in the water level at its main source, the Ruvu River. East Africa has been suffering a record drought that has seen little rainfall in Tanzania. Dar es Salaam's water authorities say they will shut off piped water to the city's nearly 6 million people every other day until water levels recover. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
52-year-old Elizabeth Maemo used to earn huge profits from her small street restaurant in Dar es Salaam. But now she's losing money due to the drought and the increase in the price of water. She says, currently I buy one bucket for 700 shillings and I use around 15 gallons a day. I can say that in my business, the scarcity of water has affected me a lot. Maemo adds that I have lost many customers as they have no faith in the water I'm using. Tanzania, much like its East African neighbors, is experiencing little rainfall, with meteorologists warning a prolonged dry season. Authorities say the water supply from the Ruvu River, the main source of the city's water, has dropped from 466 to about 300 million liters a day, whereas the city consumes an estimated 500 million liters a day. Residents are now relying on local network of boreholes and wells. For those without a source of water nearby, they are left with no option but to buy from private vendors. With the demand high and supply low, prices have risen. Sufiani Msofe is a private vendor.
He
says, for the 6 years that I have delivered water across Dar es Salaam, this is the moment I'm generating a huge profit. But when you look at the water that we sell, it is salty and not suitable for drinking. They can at least be used for cooking and washing services. With global warming causing frequent heat waves, activists say the city needs a long-term solution to its water challenges. Floyn Mshombos is an environmental activist from the One Planet Network. which advocates steps to tackle climate change.
Kutokana na ongezeko la shughuli za kibinadamu bila
Mushumbu says commercial activity along the Ruvu River has contributed significantly to lower water levels. What I think should be done to solve the challenges, he says, is to educate people about the importance of these water sources and the best way to protect them. Climate change has been a topic of major concern in the East African region, with large areas of Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia currently in the grip of severe drought. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
In Nigeria, an estimated 17,000 women die from breast cancer every year as patients often present late at clinics. A Nigerian robotics engineer is helping fight the scourge with a bra she invented that can detect breast cancer. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
In 2017, robotics engineer Kemisola Bolarinwa lost her aunt to stage 3 breast cancer. She says initially, her aunt called it a spiritual attack and was praying to God for it to go away. But as Bolarinwa mourned her loss, she decided to do something to help other women.
I have a conversation with one of the oncologists taking care of her then, and the thing I head on to in the conversation is that if you're able to detect this cancer at early stage, then the patient has the chances of getting cured. And I went to research, and my research shows that even out of 10 cases, 9 out of 10 cases can get cured.
Bolarinwa invented a so-called smart bra that takes readings of the breast and chest wall and translates the result to a mobile application within 30 minutes. She says the first model may be ready as early as April of next year.
We launched a prototype this year, February. That was when we launched the prototype, a working prototype to the patient itself. And after, we got responses from all over the world, from expertise, when I say expertise in medical field now, you know, the chipping more ideas, more guide on how we can go about it to get more accuracy, I mean, to get the more efficiency, to increase the efficiency of the device. So that has to take us back to our drawing board.
Health officials say some 72,000 cancer deaths occur in Nigeria every year and that breast cancer accounts for the highest mortality rate. They blame late detection for the high prevalence. Bolarinwa believes her invention can bridge the gap and is seeking a government partnership to help deploy the device in local clinics where women can walk in and get screened. Gloria Chinyere Oku, a breast cancer survivor, had a mastectomy in 2017 and has been battling anxiety and discrimination. But in October, she took part in a shirtless photo shoot as a way of overcoming her anxiety about her scar. She's also helping other cancer survivors embrace themselves through her work at Project Pink Blue, a breast cancer advocacy organization.
I said to the people who are down with cancer, it's not a death sentence. You know, keep pushing, keep hoping, keep believing, keep talking about your challenges. And actually, we hope that one day there will be a cure for cancer.
In December 2017, Nigeria's president signed a bill for the establishment of the National Institute for Cancer Research and Treatment. The year after that, authorities began a 4-year $200 million cancer control plan to promote early diagnosis and treatment. But cancer advocates such as Ronsi Chidebe say the government projects were underfunded and poorly implemented.
We have a very poor health system. We have a system that is so complicated. We have a system that does not cover cancer screening. We have a system that does not provide cancer screening to the population.
Through October, aid groups held cancer awareness rallies promoting early detection and healthy lifestyles, says Fatima Dambata, a doctor with the nonprofit Medicaid Cancer Foundation.
We're seeing more cases because of the change in lifestyle, consumption of preserved foods, not low exercise, poor diets, and so on.
We're trying to raise awareness, trying to make people take the screenings, the breast exams seriously.
Bola Nwa hopes her innovation will help in this process. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu in Washington, with producer Mukbeli Abaro. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.